Perfect. Okay, just before we start, I want to welcome everybody. This is the last of really 53 parts, and this I think will be. I knew last week wouldn't be the last, but I'm confident this week will be the last. 100%. So past 53, I want to really thank Dr. Mark again for really all his efforts and his interesting and all the fascinating things we learn along the way. And thank you all for coming, and we look forward. Like I mentioned, the email. We'll start, please God, Monday, August the 2nd. Take the month of July off from this class. And Monday, August 2nd, on Shaul Lieberman, back to our original series, which ran for 10 years. And you can listen to everything on the website. Over 200 talks on the great rabbinic figure. So that will begin, please God, the first Monday in August.
Or second Monday.
Second. Okay, all right. We'll see how that goes. And without further ado, class 53, a year, and then one for good luck.
And then thank everyone who's been with it for the year, especially Rabbi Kelman, who's been here every week. Yes, in fact, I'm only going to focus, I think, on that one letter because there's a lot to do. But instead of that, I want to, I took some more things from my pile. So instead of 15 minutes, maybe I'll spend 20 minutes and then we'll get into it just because I felt you'd find it interesting. First of all, I mentioned this book a couple weeks ago, Tales Out of Shul, an unorthodox journal of an Orthodox rabbi, Emmanuel Feldman. It was published in 1996, and the one I'm holding was reprinted six times, 2009. He's the rabbi. He's only had one position. He only had one position since he was a young man in Atlanta, his whole career, and then he left and went on Aliyah. So this is an interesting book with all sorts of stories. He tells you in the preface that names have been changed to protect the innocent, and most of the people the story's about are no longer with us, so he can tell the stories, but everything's true. So I just want to share with you something because it relates, it shows you how what's considered frumkeit and how it really is different than what we spoke about. If you recall many, many months ago about Jerba, I told you that in Jerba, a traditional community that never went through an enlightenment or anything like that, the women don't go to shul, not at all, not even Yom Kippur. They wouldn't go to shul. Even today, they don't go to shul. They'll come outside to hear a shofar, and that's it. So on page, this is going to annoy some of you, but then page 96 and on, he tells the story, he explains why in his shul they don't say the prayer for the state of Israel. And he gives the whole theological thing, who says it's the beginning of the redemption. Then he mentions, by the way, we don't say the prayer for the country, even though he privately does, which I can never understand. I think what it goes back to is as follows. In Europe, you had the main shul, and then you have the little shtiebels and everything. In the main shul, the official shul, they always said the prayer for the government. The small shuls, though, they did their own thing, but it was understood that in the main shul, that's when they're saying the prayer. The problem is that today in America, everyone has all these little shuls. There is no official main shul anymore. So you could have a whole city, maybe like a Muncie, and other than maybe the modern Orthodox shul, I don't know if anyone would say it. So I think it's a problem, but be that as it may, that's not what I want to talk about. He then goes on and says that there's a woman in the shul, Irene, who is very upset that they don't say the prayer for the state of Israel. And she suggests that Rabbi Feldman is under the sway of the Naturei Karta, and gets very angry at her. And then she comes to see her. She comes to see him. I finally say to her, Irene, if we were to institute this prayer next Shabbos morning, you would never know the difference. Why not? She replies, because you are never in shul and Shabbat anyway. What I did not say was that I found it most hypocritical that a person who clearly does not believe in the efficacy of prayer was making such a to-do about this one prayer. For her, clearly praying to the creator of the universe was not a religious issue, but a political issue. Now, that is like so unfair because maybe she's a traditional woman and she doesn't feel she has to go to shul. Remember what we said. So now it's like a Haredi thing that the women need, from his standpoint, that you're not a pious Jewish woman unless you go to shul. And remember I told you in Jerba, the rabbi said to me, what do women have to do with shul? Traditionally, it was never understood that women have to go to show their piety. In Hasidic world, you see the same thing today. He was saying the fact that she doesn't go to shul, then it shows she doesn't really care about the prayer. And then he said they resigned. The end of the story is that her and her husband resigned because they thought that they didn't want to be a member of a shul, which didn't say a prayer for the state. So I thought that was a little bit strange. Last week, we spoke about wearing tefillin. And a few of you mentioned that think it was Justin and Isser, that the Rav Shechter mentions in Nefesh HaRav that Rav Soloveitchik also didn't also put it on, tied all the fingers before he put the head on. And indeed, they are correct. I had forgotten this. It's page 105. But I think Rav Shechter misses Ha'ikar Chasar Min HaSefer. The essence of the truth of this matter is missing from Rav Shechter's book. Why do I say that? Because he reports that when he put on the shalyad, he put everything on, including down to the fingers, before he put the head on. And he says, because Rabbi Soloveitchik was concerned with the opinion that wrapping the fingers is part of the essence of the mitzvah. And then he quotes that Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned, and Mishkanat Yaakov deals with this, etc. He doesn't mention Reb Chaim. I think that's what we weren't last week, that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik did it that way. So I don't think it's as Rav Shechter portrays it, that the Rav was just pondering this matter and said, well, there is such a sheet. No, that's his family Masorah. And Rav Shechter goes on, however, that once in Shul, some balabas came over to him and he saw that he was doing it wrong, I guess you would say, in quotes, and he asked him about it. And Rav Soloveitchik replied, you're right, I forgot. You know, I wrapped the fingers because I forgot. And he says Rav Soloveitchik didn't want to explain to a balabas, the different shitas and the Rambam, etc. But there you have it. A couple of you, or actually one of you asked me, I mentioned this picture of the Rav. So let me share the picture that I thank David Eisen for giving me. Here you go. You got it, I believe, from Rabbi Rakefet. Here it is. This is, I published it here. Who is it? The bride is Gladys Reese or Rice. I said it shows the Rav in his Hasidic side. Thanks to David Eisner of Aaron McKeffer for providing the picture. Lo and behold, Gladys Rice is the sister of Rabbi Alvin Marcus of West Orange, the rabbi of the shul, the big shul in West Orange. She just passed away about a year and a half ago, and I brought the picture to the Shiva, and they did not even know about the picture. They knew who she was and the Rav was there, but they had not seen this picture. Thanks to Chaim Dalfin, the Chabadnik, he found out who she was in the picture. So there is the picture I mentioned. Thank you for that, for whoever asked me. I mentioned a woman who wrote a volume of responsa. I was talking about the change of women. It's actually not responsa. Here it is. The book is Malka Pietrzakowski, I guess he's pronounced the name, and it's articles, very thick book. You see how big this book is. She's a rabbanit, and I guess it's really halachic articles. Never before has there been, we've had women write articles on halacha, but never before such a thick book in which she shows that she's the equal of all these rabbis who are writing halachic works as well. So anyone who's interested, call your attention to that. Okay. I mentioned Rabbi Dabritsky. I listened to it. For some reason, I was, at first I said that he passed away a few years ago. And then I was reading, looking at the pictures, and I said, there's a picture there that says 16 years ago. And I said, could he have passed away 16 years ago? No, he didn't. Passed away 16 years ago. Here's another picture of him, as I suspected, as I remembered. It was just like 3 years ago. There's Rabbi Dabritsky. Rav Aryeh Leib, he challenged me because I was speaking about, I mentioned the word shechacha, the sefer we saw last week, Isaiah Pick. And I used, hold on, where's the word? Well, here's the book. You can even buy it, I see, on AB Books in England. Omer HaShechacha. It's a play. It's an aleph in the title. It's a play on the Torah phrase, Omer with an ayin. You forget the sheet, Leket Shechacha of Peah. And here's the word. Oops, no, there. That's not what I want to show you. Here's the word. So I pronounced it Shechacha. So Rav Aryeh Leib says to me, no, it's not. I pronounced it wrong. He says, why did I pronounce it that way? It should be a shva nach under the chaf. I'm throwing this last piece of grammar in for all the people who protested when I said that only a few of us are interested in grammar. So I replied to Aryeh Leib that, well, we have a principle that when you have two of the same sound, The first one, the Shva, becomes a Shvana, so Hallelu. Incidentally, the Radak holds, as I recall, it's the Radak, it's Hallelu, but we assume Hallelu. So Aryeleib, Rabbi Aryeleib responds properly, but these are not the same letters. They're two different letters. And here is my reply in two ways to Rabbi Aryeleib. Well, first of all, you are correct. However, we as Ashkenazim, we don't pronounce it as separate letters. We pronounce it pretty much the same. The truth is, I mean, Rabbi Aryeleib asked me, so then what about, you see this word in Shmos, Perek 29, Pasuk Yud Aleph, how do you pronounce that first word there? Do you say it? Most Balei Kriya, I think, would say V'shachatata. And Rabbi Aryeleib is correct that is a mistake. You don't say V'shachatata.
V'shachata.
Yes, if you listen to Rabbi Weider, it's V'shachatata, V'shachatata. However, so all I'll say to Rabbi Aryeleib is when we speak, however, it's not the same thing as when you have a word shikha in Atari, you have to say shikha. However, I'll give you an example. We have a principle that a shiva, the opening shiva has to be a shiva na. You can never have a shiva nach begin a word. On the other hand, we speak it all the time. We say that. We say bracha. If you're reading from the Torah, you have to say beracha. We say Sfarad. That's a Shva Nach at the beginning of the word. If you read the Torah, you'd have to say, or Tanakh, you'd have to say Sefarad. In speaking, it's okay. We can say Bracha, we can say Sfarad, and we can also say Shechacha. That's my answer. Take it to the bank, in my opinion. Now, two more things. I said last class, I showed you this. We're going to go about 5 minutes longer than normal because I want to finish up. We were talking about Rabbi Fixer. We're going to get back to him in a minute about vegan restaurants. And this article I showed, and he discusses it from the Jerusalem Post. He quotes it. What do you do on Shabbos? They can now, if they can create a thing where you have these sensors on your brain and you can move a car or do any moacha, is that usher? And so they discuss it there. After the class, I remembered something. The Chida wrote a travelogue. It's called Magal Tov. And believe it or not, in his travelogue, he speaks about the Shach, and he says as follows. Look at line, page, I made a note of it here for myself. Yeah, he quotes an old rabbi, and he says as follows. That this rabbi told him, Otsi per shashacha yodea shema kotev. Shema kotev is, for the Mekubalim, you have this idea that if you know the secret name that allows writing, it's a special name, what happens? Hu ayam adaber v'akomos kosev me'elav. You could speak the holy name and the pen would write by itself. And there's all sorts of discussions. Can you do this on Shabbos? They assume, no, you're not allowed to do it on Shabbos, and they bring proofs. So here we see, and there's others as well, but the Chida mentions that the Shach had this special ability that he could cause the pen to write without picking it up. And that's, so whenever they're going to have discussions about the car moving on Shabbos, just through your mind, they're going to give examples. They're going to use this as an example. Another good example of, you might not believe in it, but the principle is important. I don't know if any of us listening believe that you can cause a pen to write without you, just because you know some holy word. But if the poskim believed and they discuss it and they establish the principle that it's usher on Shabbos, that could be applied to another case. I'll give you an additional case where I use this as an example. Well, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg is speaking about a case of Mamzerus. A man was gone. He's gone more than 9 months, and lo and behold, his wife gets pregnant. So you assume, obviously, it's Mamzerus. However, there's a shita of the Bahag. The Bahag holds that maybe the husband, even though we haven't seen him, it could be 10 months, 11 months, whatever, how long he's gone, and we know he went across the sea, maybe he returned home by using the Shem HaMaforash, and he had what they call Kvitzas Derech. That is, he was able to go very fast, you know, end up where he is. So therefore, you can't assume the kid's a mamzer. Now, none of us believe that you can travel across the world using the Shema Forish like that. However, we do believe in Lufthansa. So here you have an example of something the Bahag said that factually in his time had no reality to it, but the poskim who believed in it spoke about the principle, and now we can apply it today. Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg does apply it, that even though we haven't seen the husband, he might have come back. Granted, it's not with the Shem Mefarish, but it's with an airplane. And that's how you can use ideas, which maybe you don't accept the validity of it. For example, the ideas having with demons, etc. Two more things I want to show you. I misquoted something, so we like to be exact. So here it is. I gave you the example of the Satmar. Where is it here? Got to close up all these things here. I published this. I thought it was in World War II. Well, it was during when the state was declared. It's not. Here's a letter from one of the Satmar leaders, which they found in the Arab archives. During World War II, it doesn't have a date, in which he's writing to the Muslims and he says to them, this Arye Weisfish, that we, and I could send it to anyone or I published it, that we are from the old, the Dora Yashan. We've never been involved in politics. We've always been opposed to the politics of the Tzionim. We respect the Arab peoples. And then it says, Al-Kain Ani Mavakesh, we request from you. It begins because it's saying that it's possible that the German troops are going to enter Eretz Yisrael. So it says, we appeal to you that don't take it out on us, traditional Jews. And if you want, I will give you the names of our community. We're talking about like the Eda Haredi types. He says that he says it's possible that the Arabs will be angry at the Jews and will take revenge. He says here that... Where does he say that they're in? I'll give you the names of the family. You'll know not to take any revenge against them because they're not interested. Most of them are in Jerusalem, a few in Tveria. And then he says there's some elsewhere. This reminds, someone sent me Reb Mordechai from Brooklyn a few years ago. Mishpacha magazine published a piece from Rabbi Avi Shafra during when they were having these terrorist attacks. We, the Haredi community, have no interest in going up to Temple Mount. We oppose this. So please stop murdering us. And the author of this article is saying that that's disgraceful. When the Arabs are, when you have terrorists coming to kill, don't say because I wear a black hat and a bekasha that I'm not your enemy, In other words, don't kill us. If you want to do a terrorist attack, the implication is, he doesn't say go kill someone else, but the implication is don't kill us. Because we're not causing all these problems. We don't go on the Temple Mount. You can find other Jews to kill. And finally, my last point I want to say to you before we return to a very interesting issue of that of the vegan restaurants is, I told you that great story, that great piece from Crandall, the Rebbetzin who was so learned. I subsequently found another piece that the Chasam Sofer quotes from her. It was pointed out to me. Crandall means crown, Atara. But just to show you how not everyone had this view, I think you'll appreciate this. When I say appreciate it, it doesn't mean you like it, but I'm not interested in making you feel good. It's in this book, Meged Givot Olam. I have to keep this up 53 weeks, because I have a few of you who are saying we wait for the first 15 minutes. I don't know if you tune out after that because you think it's all the good stuff. But this is from a Michal Zalman Shurkin. Michal Zalman Shurkin is a big Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, but he comes from the very right-wing world. In the 70s, you had a few of these Talmudim who came to YU just to hear the Shirim, but did not accept the ideas of Rav Soloveitchik. Philosophical ideas did not accept YU. They're there at, some of them are now at Torah Moshe in Jerusalem and at Yeshiva. Rabbi Meiselman himself is an example of that, a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik who never accepted Rabbi Soloveitchik's, his Weltanschauung, his ideas. But they are, it's a strange phenomenon because you can listen to Shirim on the website, they quote Rav Soloveitchik, and yet they're in the camp of what we call the Peleg, Rav Shmuel Arbach. They're the most extreme of the Haredi camp, and yet they still hold of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Well, you can always square the circle if you want. But he's a fine Talmud Chacham in many ways. And he has a great book of stories here. And in this book, he says as follows. This is on page 15. Listen to this story. He says, I'm going to tell you a story from how my father educated his children. One day he came back from the yeshiva. My older sister came to him. Tati, I want to learn Torah. Learn with me a page of Gemara. When he heard this, his father was a little his face turned white, and he took $10 out of his pocket, and he says, $10, as he's American, he grew up in America. That's a lot of money in those days. And he gave it to his sister and said, go buy a dress for yourself. And she went and bought a, and was very happy she can go buy her dress. When she left, I asked my father, what happened, you know, that she wanted to learn Torah, and what happened that all of a sudden she wants to learn Torah? And he says, he said, Adarab, on the contrary, let her learn some Torah. And he told the following story. He says, when I was in Radin, this is his father, who's also a well-known Talmud Chacham, there was the draft decree. So I went from place to place to try to escape the draft decree, to try to raise money, to bribe the person in charge, so you didn't have to go to the draft. And he says, I came to a small town, and the rabbi of it, he doesn't say who his name is, was a Gadol B'Yisrael, a Torah scholar, and we started speaking and learning. He was quite old, but he said, Gon HaGaoni Mamash. But since he was rabbi in a small town, no one heard of him. And we spoke in learning, and he showed me this big manuscript of the Minchas Chinuch. And then he says, did you write this? And the rabbi says to him, no, this is my daughter's work. And his father was like shocked. Your daughter did this? And he said that when he came to the city, there was no people to study Torah with. They're all a bunch of ignoramuses. So I began to study with my daughter, and she became very learned. And I went with her day and night, and she wrote this work on the Minchas Chinuch. And he says my father was, he was amazed by this. And then the daughter comes in, and lo and behold, she's quite elderly. And then the father, her father, is starting to cry. And he asked him later, why are you crying? And he says, because this end of the story is that when he tried to get shiduchim for the daughter, they brought a shidduch from the yeshiva mem. That must be Mir. He wasn't learning enough. She asked him a question on Tara, and he never learned Masachas Olos. Then he brought a bachur from another yeshiva, Tet, that must be Tells. Again, the same thing, that the daughter was more learned than him. And lo and behold, she wasn't satisfied with any of these people. She was too learned. And she never ended up marrying. And then he ends the story. Mikoach kocha, from this story, my sister got a new dress. In other words, the father's idea was that if you educate, and maybe in those days it was true, but if you educate the girls too much, they will feel that they'll know more than the husbands. And you can't have a wife know more than a husband, know more Torah than a husband. I mean, I'm sure this Rabbanit who's appearing on Torah Motion, she knows more than her husband, but that's today. And so you see a very different idea that she'll be an old maid. She'll never be able to get married because she's always going to be looking for someone. I guess she felt she made the promise with the girl also. She felt that she had to find a bacher who knew more than her. Okay, my friends, we are now returning to this fascinating discussion, which is relevant for any people who travel, about vegan restaurants. I introduced it to you. And I want to begin continuing the discussion. Thank you to Mel. He called my attention to Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, he mentioned a few times. Let me show you on the screen here so anyone can. He is one of the most popular Torah teachers on the internet, literally. He does these 10-minute halachas, which discuss everything under the sun, very interesting, and he has thousands and thousands of shiurim. He recently went to YU, his father-in-law listens or used to listen to be on our classes. So this is Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. So let me quickly go through what Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz says. He was asked the question, explain to you how Rabbi Fixler and Rosh Shabta Rapport would answer this, and then go through Rosh Shabta what Rabbi Fixler says. One more thing I forgot to show you, here is Rosh Shabta Rapport, the grandson-in-law of Ramosha Feinstein, who's an important part of this story here. So it's a 10-minute talk, and he identifies 10 problems that he says are are issues with vegan restaurants. First, he raises the issue about a vegan restaurant with no hashgacha or a vegan restaurant with hashgacha that you wouldn't normally use. Now, I think you really need to expand on the latter point for the simple reason that we all acknowledge that a hashgacha on a Dunkin' Donuts or in a vegan restaurant doesn't need to be at the same level as a meat restaurant. And he himself acknowledged that at the end of the talk. But here are the eight things. So let me tell you what the eight things are. And if you ask your local rabbi, you probably get this answer. And how I think Rabbi Rappaport and Rabbi Fiks will respond. First of all, Rabbi Leibowitz says that you could have tiny quantities of animal product to get in the food. And trace ingredients is the words he uses. I know the answer of Rabbi Fiks or Rabbi Rappaport would be trace ingredients are not relevant. Trace ingredients, they're all bottle. So it's not a concern. Then he says the kaling, the utensils, might not be kosher. That is, maybe they didn't buy them from scratch. In other words, now they're being used for vegetarian. Maybe they in past had been used for meat or all sorts of other things. And I don't know. I don't know if anyone would say this is a real concern. You're supposed to be worried at this. I don't know. You'd have to ask Posky. I'm not sure if this is a real concern. Most of the time you get a restaurant, they start off, they buy new pots. I don't know. Then he discusses number three, that there could be grape juice and wine vinegar. That's an absolute problem. And we'll see what Rabbi Fiksler says. That there's no doubt. Then he discusses bishulakum. Bishulakum is the big one that we'll talk about today. We spoke about last class, a non-Jew can't cook for you. What I pointed out, however, and Rav Yitzchak Yosef doesn't get this either. Rav Yitzchak Yosef, as we saw last week, the Rishon LeZion attacks Rabbi Fiksler, and he focuses on bishulakum. On the assumption that if the restaurant has a mashgiach, there is no bishulakum, but that's not the reality. Not one of these Indian type restaurants in New York or anywhere else has a Jew owning it. And they're all bishulakum. The mashgiach comes in yotzei v'nichnas whenever he comes in. So if bishulakum is the problem, then this applies to all these restaurants. And I told you that in the New York area, they're only under the fringe hashgachot. But when you go, let's say, to the small towns in America, it's the mainstream rabbis, the rabbis of the shuls, who are giving it on them. So that's an issue we're going to discuss a little bit later. And this would be for Rabbi Leibowitz. I only would say that this is not just an issue about the vegan restaurant without a mashgiach. It applies to all vegan restaurants. I asked this question to Rabbi Yaakov Spivak. Rabbi Yaakov Spivak, who passed away just a few months ago, he gave hashgachas to a number of these places. I knew him for years. He actually taught at my school. He used to have a radio program for those people in New York. It was Zev Brenner. He was also a musician. He's an Eretz Yisrael Musmach, and I got to know him for a while. We spoke many, many times. So much so, he asked me to be the local mashgiach in Montclair, New Jersey. He gave hashgacha to Wayne's Indian restaurants. He wanted me the mashgiach, but I didn't want to be the mashgiach. I don't want to get involved in this issue here. But I asked him straight out, what about bishulakum? And he said to me, and he gave hashgacha until he passed away to Cafe Viva on the Upper West Side and some of these tofu-type places, these vegan places. He said to me that it is not olah al shulchan malachim. Your Indian food is not, and these tofu places, and the places where they serve pasta. He says you're not going to serve pasta, you know, at a state dinner. So and pizza, you're not serving at a state dinner. So he said that, in his opinion, he said it's not bishulakum. The fifth concern, bugs. A couple of you asked me about bugs. So we'll see in a few minutes what Rabbi Fiksler says about bugs. I had this question as well with a different rabbi. Let me show you a picture. We've seen him before. He passed away just a few years ago, Rav Chaim Dovber Golevsky. When he passed away, I think it was earlier this year, he was the second to last person from the Torah world of Brisk. The Rabbi Soloveitchik in Israel died was the other. This is the grandson of Simcha Zelig Grieger. I took this picture. I went to visit him twice. This is on the wall of his house in Borough Park. That's Reb Chaim, of course. And that's his grandfather who was murdered in the Holocaust, the Dayan, Reb Simcha Zelig Grieger. Notice how he dressed. We have pictures of him. He never dressed in rabbinic garb. None of them did, by the way. Here's another picture I took. Menachem Butler is interested in all this sort of stuff. So I asked him, does he want to come meet Rabbi Golevsky? Rabbi Golevsky was in Shanghai. incidentally. He was part of Klitsk, Rav Aaron Kotler's yeshiva, and he made his way to Japan and then to Shanghai. He gave Ashgacha an Indian vegetarian restaurant. Those who went to YU, like in the 50s, will remember him perhaps. He didn't teach at YU. He taught at, I don't know what it was called, Isaac Breuer College. Before it was Isaac Breuer, maybe Teachers College or something. Believe it or not, he also worked at the B'nai Akiva camp in New Jersey, he told me. Wrote many Sfarim. So I asked him, what about the bugs? Because he gives Ashgacha to an Indian restaurant. And he said, and we're going to see the same thing with Rafixler, that you don't need to be concerned with these Indians. They don't eat bugs. They're just as makpid as Jews are. It's part of their religion. There's health reasons. And he didn't say religion, actually. He says it's dangerous in India. Others will say religion. Okay. The sixth concern of Rabbi Leibowitz, I don't mean to downplay the first five concerns. I think those are like mainstream. And what Rabbi Fixler and Rabbi Appel are saying is sort of like not so mainstream. But the sixth one here and the seventh one, and it's not mainstream at all. He says that who's checking that the products in the restaurant, they might be from Israel, who checking about Trumos and Maisros? This I don't understand at all. According to this, you can't go and you can't buy on the street. You can't buy you can't buy vegetables. I don't think the restaurants that are under Hashgacha, I know they're checking where the vegetables come from. The vegetables come from the local supermarket. I've never heard of such a concept that you have to go ask the manager, who has to call the distributor and find out where they come from. That's not a concern. That because just like it's not a concern if you buy it off the street, if you buy vegetables. Furthermore, although I checked today, all the standard kosher sites say that if you buy things from Israel and it's not under Hashgacha, like a Jaffa orange, it doesn't say something, you have to there's a whole procedure, you have to take truma. However, I hate to say it, but maybe I should say, this is Rav Avad Yosef, the greatest posik of our time. If you look in Yabia Omer, volume 11, number 46, he says you don't need to do Trumot, worry about Trumot or mice or anything from Israel. You don't need to do it. And he explains why you don't need to do it. I don't know. Certainly, Limud Tzlus, because most people, they're not doing that, even if they know it comes from Israel. And then the seventh reason he gives is that these vegan restaurants often have an affiliation with Buddhism, which he thinks is Avodah Zarah, and they'll serve the food to the Avodah Zarah before giving it to you. Quote, it is only when Buddha says, no thanks, not hungry today, that they give it to you. Again, this is just, none of this is true. This is not a serious argument. There's no promotion of Avodah Zarah. If the person happens to be Avodah Zarah, I reject the idea that a Buddhist is an Oved Avodah Zarah. We'll see in a second. But even if he is an Oved Avodah Zarah, so what? What does that have to do? Even if there's a picture of the Buddha, when you walk in, what does that have to do with, it might not be such a great thing for a guy to give a hashgacha to it if there's a big Buddha there, but what does that have to do with the food? They're not giving it to the idol or anything. None of that takes place. And the eighth one is his reason, is what's the ne'amanut, the ne'amanus, can you believe the non-Jew when they tell you they're not serving treif? So whenever you offer many arguments, even if a few of them are a stretch, like six and seven are clearly are, but the others are solid. And if you go to the various websites that discuss why you can't in the vegan restaurant, they repeat the arguments, not six or not seven, but they definitely repeat all the other arguments, 1 through 5 and 8. So that would imply that vegan restaurants are a problem. We'll see in a second what Rabbi Fixler is replying to this. But before we get to that, I'm going to blow you off your seats now. I'm going to shock you with something. That, believe it or not, Yeshiva University, or at least one of Rabbi Leibowitz's co-Rosh Yeshivot, holds of Rabbi Fixler and Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport. How do I know this? You got to see it now. I saved it in case they take it down, but it's still up, so you can see it. Also on YU Torah, Rabbi David Horowitz, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan, actually has a PhD also, which is unusual. There's only a few of them, Rabbi Rodenzweig, and also Rabbi Weider have PhDs. But as it begins, this is from 2007. Last summer, I served as the rabbinic advisor to the students of the Shabbosim Honors Program at Yeshiva College as they went on a 12-day visit to Japan. And he, this whole article he has here, which he has a shiur also as well, is discussing halachic issues, halachic problems in Japan. He begins by discussing the international dateline. I don't want to go into that now. Listen to the classes I gave on the Mir Yeshiva, also on Rav Zalman Meltzer, and you hear about the problems. Where is the dateline? Is Japan, like the Chazon Ish felt, in Japan, should Shabbos be Sunday? Or like many other Gedolim felt, it should be Saturday? Interestingly, on their trip to Japan, they decided to hold Shabbos on Saturday, but Torah prohibitions also on Sunday. And they had a non-Jew, Professor Lee, who was with them, who could assist them. And Rabbi Horowitz tells us that he heard, that, and it's true, that some of the students in the Mir Yeshiva, when they were in Japan before they went to Shanghai, they were only in Japan a few months and then they went to Shanghai, they did that as well. This is an unusual example of something that the Hamonam, in this case, Yeshiva students, came up on their own. As far as I know, no posek, maybe today they say it, but in its time ever did. In other words, there were two opinions. There was the opinion that you observe Shabbos on Sunday, and then there was the opinion of the Chazon Ish that you observe it on Saturday. No one said to do both. The Chazon Ish didn't say to do both. His idea was that you have to be Mechal Shabbos on Shabbos, on Saturday, to show that it's not Shabbos. And the chief rabbinate and others who said to do it on Sunday, said to do it on Shabbos, didn't say to keep the Oraisas on Sunday. It's the yeshiva students who decided to be choshesh for both opinions that they did it. It's an interesting case of where the masses, as it were, on their own, don't know which opinion to do, so they do something that the poskim themselves have never said to do. If you would live in Japan, you couldn't do this. I think you'd pick the standard view, what the Chabad does. That's Shabbos, is Saturday. But to visit just for one weekend, it's not such a problem. Then, I'll skip the part we're going to focus on. He goes to he deals with another issue of they have these gardens in Japan, and can you enter into Buddhist temples? He says this, he says something which so I don't get. He speaks of Buddhism. He says that he acknowledges that a Buddhist temple is not a place of avodah zarah to a foreign god, but he said that acts of foreign worship, in any event, certainly take place in the Buddhist temple. Thus, it would certainly be usher to enter the temples. I don't get it. If the Buddhist temple is not a place of avodah zarah, then how could there be acts of foreign worship of avodah zarah in the Buddhist temple? If Buddhism is not avodah zarah, then how could you have an act of avodah zarah making it usher? What does that mean? Isn't the place of avodah zarah meaning a place where you worship a foreign god? He then says, and you can read this, that the masses would pray to the Buddha to help them achieve their goals in life. And this violates the fifth of the 13 principles of the Rambam, and thus makes the temple of avodah zarah. And again, I say, since when are non-Jews obligated in the fifth principle of the Rambam? Not to mention the fact that plenty of Jews violate the fifth principle of the Rambam, and they pray to deceased saints and all sorts of things. We spoke in the past about requesting and praying to Rav Yishai of Karastir, and in Morocco what they do. And people pray to angels, various prayers. So he asked Ed Sadikim to help them. He says people ask the Buddha to help them achieve certain things. I know plenty of people who would ask dead tzaddikim to assist them. So I don't see that either. I don't see what the avodah zarah is, and it's Buddhism is not avodah zarah, classic Buddhism. There have been sects and groups of Buddhism where I'm sure it does fall into Buddhism, into avodah zarah. But then what I'm interested here is the middle part. Listen to this. Kashrut in Kyoto. In Kyoto, where we stayed for two nights, we faced an interesting dilemma. As there was no Chabad house, if we wanted to eat anything besides the food that we personally brought from Tokyo or the US, we would have to go to the 100% vegetarian Buddhist restaurant. No fish of any type was served in these establishments either. But how can one be sure that the Buddhist laws of 100% vegetarian do not contain any animal emulsifiers or other ingredients from non-kosher animals? Then he's saying, something's missing here. Are their standards equivalent to Hilchos Taharovos? According to the Buddhist doctrine, one may not eat any admixture of animal product. Thus, according to their standards, even if a food contains a mixture of an animal product and vegetable product with a proportion of less than 1/60, it would still be prohibited for a Buddhist to eat. But how can we be sure that the Buddhist proprietors of the restaurants were not fooling everyone? He says, in the final analysis, we relied on the principle of Uman Lomara Cheskate, that is, that a worker, you know, he's not going to do something that destroys his reputation. We can rely on the fact that a restaurant that advertises itself as no animal products is not going to do something that could destroy their livelihood. A practitioner will not willfully destroy his reputation being dishonest. And then he explains that this is similar to our parents and grandparents' generation when they used to look at the ingredients and rely on it. And today we have hashgachas, but in those days you relied on the assumption, which is a halachic assumption, that if the company tells you there's no animal shortening, there is no animal shortening. We could assume that they were telling the truth. We could not know for sure that the providers were not lying. Yet according to well-worn halachic rules, we could assume that they were telling the truth. So we took our shoes off, sat down on our tatami mats, and ordered. So now you see from Yeshiva University, their official trip, they're going to a vegan restaurant. And then he goes on, what about Bishalakum, who we spoke about last week? And he explains that there's no problem with soy products in the soup because those would not be Olal Shulchan Malachim. He says rice poses a problem. He discusses the idea of Olal Shulchan Malachim, that you'd serve it like a steak dinner. While he says, in Japan, everyone eats rice, from the poorest peasant to Emperor Akihito. The emperor might have fancy dishes, he says, but he's also eating rice. So Rabbi Horowitz poskened, we simply could not eat any rice product. With the help of our Japanese translator, I had to request to the proprietors of the restaurant that I turn on the oven in which our hoped-for rice dish could be prepared. And in one place, he says it was successful. In another place, they didn't want to restart it to make a new batch of rice. So in there, they just relied on the soy. What you see here is halacha lemaisa, whereas Rosh Yeshiva number one at YU says absolutely forbidden. Rosh Yeshiva number two, Rabbi David Horowitz, he says permitted. And he not only say permitted, he took the YU students and he wrote about it in a whole halachic article explaining this. And to Joel, who emailed me about being told by this Haredi businessman who said that you can go, who said, told you that you can eat in these vegan places in Asia. He eats in them if they're religious because they're not going to go against their religion. And you asked me what would be based on. Here you have David Horowitz, one of the Rosh Yeshiva YU, explaining it. Now, I saved this page because you never know. Maybe this is going to go out of style and they're going to take it down, but I have it. So let me now return to Rabbi Fixler and my question to Rabbi Rappaport, where this all was. Nothing I'm saying is halacha l'maisa. Ask your local rabbis, but it's worthwhile knowing that it's an argument. And it's not like someone who eats there is throwing off the yoke. I also told Joel, when I was in India, this guy who I know a bit was there as well. We weren't there together. I just met him. He wears a tzitzis out all the time, you know, very firm guy. And he told me, come with him to the Jain restaurant. Jains don't eat. They are so mocked when they walk, the Jain monks, they cover their mouths so that, I won't say God forbid, because they're actually atheists, even though it's a religion. They don't want any bugs to fly in. Before they sit down, they make sure there's no bugs. They will not go near anything. They don't even believe in having pets or riding horses or things like that. So he said, I could absolutely eat there. Now, I wasn't going to eat any of these places, quite apart from the lechik angles, which I hadn't investigated enough, but because I was convinced I would be getting sick. So I would just want to eat the Chabad every night, some schnitzel, and that's it. And I ate schnitzel every single night for a week and a half. But he went there, and he believe me, he knows that. So it's not so simple. That's all I would say. So if Rabbi Fixler, quickly, let me go through Rabbi Fixler. He has his article in Tehumen, the last issue of Tehumen, which Tehumen is an important halachic annual. It's really the most original arguments, and it's mainstream religious Zionist, although they have also sometimes Haredi Rabbanim published there. And the big issue, of course, is Bishalakum. And he says as well, in a vegan restaurant, many of these things could be eaten raw. He says it's not, in general, they are not things that you would serve at a steak dinner. He cites an opinion that if you don't eat it with bread, it's not Olal Shulchan Malachim to begin with. That's a big heter. He cites the view of the Raivad, which he says, incidentally, is not the Raivad, I didn't know this. It's not the Raivad, the commenter on the Mishnah Torah. There's three Raivads. It's the other Raivad. That we saw this, that there's no Bishalakum with hired workers. Now, we don't generally rely on this, but he quotes the Ben Ish Chai that we don't protest if people do it. And the Rama says, B'diavad, you do rely on it. What does that mean, B'diavad? That is, let's say, first of all, the Noda Behuda says that all travelers are in a B'diavad situation. Based on that, you could rely on that. And also, certainly, if you came to a place and it had already been cooked, let's assume you could eat in a vegan restaurant and it's kosher, but and it was already cooked, that would be a bidyavad. You could rely on it. This issue of bidyavad, the Noda Yehuda's famous view that travelers are in a bidyavad situation. I always tell the people on our tours, we travel on those who've been with us know these 5-star tours. I don't think that that's what the Noda Yehuda was speaking about. He was speaking about when you're wandering and you don't have food, you can rely. It's like a bidyavad situation. So you come to some place and a food dish was made in a pot. The food's 100% kosher, but it turns out the pot is a non-Jewish pot, so it could have had treif in it. There you can eat it because it's a bidyavad and you're a traveler. That's when you're on a 5-star program like we are, certainly from a policy standpoint, we always tell people that the level of kashrus is going to be the same. But even quite apart from that, I don't think, I'm certain of this actually, that that's not, when they say travelers are in a bidyavad situation, they don't mean that sort of travelers. This came up on our Greece trip, actually, because there's cheese that's produced in Greece. It's called Olympus cheese. What I'm telling you now is the facts as of a few years ago. It could have changed since then. Now, the Olympus cheese is, I was wondering, could we have it? It's served in Salonika. The rabbi of the community serves it, although he said that he only takes Chol Yisrael, he serves it and has hashgacha. But I'm thinking, how do you have kosher cheese made in Greece? So I called the mashgiach in Israel, and he explained that no, he gives hashgacha, but it's he's not involved in it. So now I'm thinking this is the old heter of Rav Soloveitchik, which we don't accept anymore today. That you could eat that gevinas akum cheese, it's just like Chol V'Yisrael. It's not that the Jew has to be involved in it. You just want to know what the ingredients are. It's a machlokas, what it is. But today we assume that no, that's not enough. That tablet K, if you see it in the supermarket, that's the old way of Rav Soloveitchik. But no one today relies on it. But if you're living in Greece, where kosher food is almost impossible to get, I see that. I'm sure you could get a hector to rely on it. Then I asked, it's more interesting than that because this Olympus cheese, which was on the kosher list of Chabad of Crete, not Chabad, sorry, Chabad of Cyprus, till I explained to the Chabad rabbi what it was. But it's actually the company, the Mashgiach told me, is owned by a Jew and a non-Jew. So it's not so clear whether Gvina Sakum applies to that. I found, as I recall, it was a Pri Chodesh who says that B'diavad, you can eat it. My opinion, I'm not a posek, but if you're living in Greece where there's hardly any kosher food, you can certainly eat the Olympus cheese. But we, coming on our 5-star trip, I said to the person who was arranging it, I said, we can't eat that. You need to get us the Chol V'Yisrael cheese from France, they got it from. He was very upset. He's acting as if, like, what, you think you're more pious than us and we're eating treif? I tried to explain to him, it's not that. It's that, in America, we have different standards, et cetera. So that's a principle. Then Fixler says, returning to our case, that and he cites source for this that when the Raiva gave this hetter that some people rejected it. It's talking about a Jewish servant. If you have a non-Jewish servant, and he or she cooks for you, so the Raiva held that that's okay because you're not going to have feelings of intimacy. It's a worker, and others disagreed. But Rabbi Fixler brings a source to show that it's different. We're even more removed in a restaurant, because this is not your servant. This is just a worker. And the concept of a restaurant didn't exist in medieval times the way we're thinking. That's anyone who cooked for you wasn't Jewish. You had some relationship. But you go to the restaurant today, you don't know who's cooking. You never see the person. So he's providing all sorts of examples to try to permit vegan restaurants. As for the wine vinegar or wine, he says, absolutely, you cannot order anything that has wine or wine vinegar in it. And he says you can assume that if they tell you it's nothing in it, you can rely on them because of allergies and everything like that. If they tell you, you can believe it. Then you get to the issue of the kalim. And originally I said that he didn't deal with it, but he did. And this is the question I asked Rabbi Rappaport. And if you look at the email I have from Rabbi Rappaport, which I had sent to Rabbi Fixler before the article, and where Rabbi Fixler writes, the words are identical basically to what Rabbi Rappaport wrote me. My question, so that's where the formulation comes from. I'm convinced of that. I said, you go to this restaurant, this vegan restaurant, let's assume everything's kosher. but they're cooking with the wine vinegar. That treats up the utensils, doesn't it? So he says as follows. Rabbi Fixer says one thing that Rabbi Rapport doesn't. Rabbi Fixer wonders whether today anything absorbs. With stainless steel, it doesn't really absorb. Now, if that's the case, then you can use one. We don't assume this because so we still have milchik and fleishik pots, but it could be that we just have it because that's the halacha and it's a halachic concept of what we call bria, absorption, but it's not actually a scientific concept. But I don't get this argument because we don't rely on it in practice. But he says, first of all, he says, tell them not to make the food in the pot they use for vinegar. And what does Rabbi Rapport roll me? And this is Rabbi Fixer also repeats. First of all, he says, any good restaurant does not mix the pots. They're not mixing something, which I don't know if this is true, but they don't want tastes being absorbed. So they're not going to, the pot they're using the vinegar, and if you say not to make it in that, they're not going to use that. Second of all, Rabbi Rapport says, and this is the letter from Rabbi Rapport to me, a whole email to me. He says that when it deals with the vinegar, even if it gives taste, we don't want this taste. This taste does not add anything to it. It doesn't make it better. On the contrary, it makes it worse. What we call it tam lifgam. And in such a case, since we don't want vinegar, you don't want vinegar in this dish of yours, it's going to ruin it. Only a few dishes use it in. Therefore, you can see this absorbed vinegar, as we call nosim tam lifgam, and it doesn't trafe it up. And he ends off his letter to me, Rabbi Rapoport. You don't need to be concerned that maybe they cooked something. Because first of all, it's not going to be in the pot they make for you. And second of all, even if it was, you don't need to be concerned. What about the bugs? Rabbi Fixer takes this up as well. And he says that the same thing I mentioned, Rabbi Golevsky, the non-Jews in these vegan places, they don't want to eat bugs. Their cleaning is also very good. It's not a real concern, he thinks. The fact that he says it's not a real concern, this gets us into the old issue as to how much of a concern are bugs. Some people think it's a super concern. Others are not so concerned with it. You can listen to David Lichtenstein's show about a year and a half ago, where he had two Israeli rabbis, one speaking as if bugs are the end of the world. Everything you open, there's lots of bugs. And another rabbi saying it's not really an issue. You look, you don't see anything. If you see something, it's a problem. If not, but you don't need these light boards and you don't need to ban vegetables and certain vegetables. And this rabbi says that he's following the psukim of Rav Asher Weiss. Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz, who was the teacher of Rabbi Fixler, he said as follows, I think this is the mainstream view. Could be wrong, but I think it is. Everyone acknowledges if you don't see the bug, it's not a problem. Question is, let's say you see a little dot, little black dot. If you listen to the guy in Israel, he wrote this book, forget his name, begins with a Vav, his last name. He was on Lichtenstein's show. His attitude is, and I'm sure he has authorities who back this, that if you see the black dot and then you take out the microscope or the magnifying glass and you see it's a bug, that's usser. Because you can see it with your eyes. Yes, Ramosha Vaya. You see it with your eyes. The magnifying glass only helps you to determine what you're seeing. Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz said otherwise. He said, and many other poskim as well, that if you cannot make out with your eye, and a normal eye, you have to be 20/20, 20/30, whatever, 20/40, I don't know, in pre-modern times, most people don't have such good eyes. If you can't make it out that it's a bug, and all you see is a dot, that's not a problem. You don't need to be concerned with that because in pre-modern times, they didn't have these things. They weren't concerned with it either. So I think the dispute is about this. But Rabbi Fixler doesn't think it's such a problem. And if there are some bugs that happen to make it in, they're going to be smushed up and then they're buttled. Finally, he asks, can you believe the non-Jew? And he's the same argument. He says that you can believe them, that they don't want to destroy the reputation. He even says that this group of vegans came to Gush Katif because they wanted to be sure. They took out samples of the dirt to make sure that there was no bugs or anything in it before they bought the lettuce. And then he concludes, in vegetarian restaurants, nothing is from animal products, and therefore there's no Torah prohibition there. He says there's no bishalakum for the reasons we saw. There's no chashash, no fear of marriage, because there's no connection between the cooker and the eater, that these are not the foods that you're going to serve at a feast. And even if you say that they are, like potatoes, we said, he has a heter there that because it's not eaten with bread. Now, in the notes, or in one of the responses, the response is that he's looking for a heter. He's looking, he's putting all these different kulas together. Maybe he is. And then he says, so he concludes that it is permitted to eat in places where they're strictly vegan. Just do not request food that have vinegar. And it's better to say that you're allergic to it. And then, as I said, this article achieves the haskama, the approbation of Rabbi Shabtai Cohen Rappaport. There are two other things I'll mention related to this. Sohar. Sohar is, do I have it here? Yes. Sohar is this organization of rabbis, religious Zionist rabbis. They came out with this booklet some years ago, and it's all about kashrus in chutz aretz. It seems Israelis don't have a clue. They're so used to everything they buy is under hashkacha. So if you look in this on page 24, they're more strict than Rabbi Fixler. But there are some interesting points here. Yeah, you're dealing with Israelis, religious Israelis who are going to India, who are going to Latin America. And they say that, first of all, when it comes to Olah Shulchan Malachim, you can assume that rice and corn can be made for you. There's no problem with bishlakum. In Japan, we saw Rabbi Horowitz doesn't think so. And then they say, and he says, this is very relevant to our young people who travel to Latin America. Now, I've never had a tortilla, but it's in Latin America. It says one of the basics in Latin America, basic foods is tortilla, which comes from corn and water. And they've investigated it. And in Mexico, in Ecuador, Colombia, etc., they never put anything else in it except for the corn. What do you call that again? Cornmeal, I guess it is. Cornmeal and things from cactus and other things. But there's no margarine. There's no oils. There's nothing in it. And therefore, it is mutar liknot tortilla b'chol makom. Zehu macha basisi shevadai eno mugdar olo shocham lachim. So here we have psak from Tsoar, that when you travel back in America, you can always buy a tortilla. Sort of like when you're in France, they would tell you you could buy those big breads. And Halacha Lamaisa, they conclude that if you're in a vegetarian restaurant and you don't have any kosher food, you can eat there, but under these circumstances, there has to be no vinegar or anything else. Don't eat anything that has... could have bugs in it, although it does say yesh makom latir broccoli. You can permit broccoli. Things that do have bugs but were already cooked, if they're already cooked after the fact, you could eat them. Cooked items, however, he says, could be problematic unless you see that the kalim, the utensils, did not cook anything before that was not kosher. So I guess it's pretty similar to Rabbi Fixler. They're saying that if you're in a place, how do you confirm that the pot wasn't used earlier to cook the vinegar stuff? I don't know. He doesn't say to, but he does say that you can cook. I take back what I said. He pretty much is saying the same thing as Fixler is saying. If you can establish b'tzura brura shebakelim lo bushal davar isur lifnei kein. I don't know how you determine that clearly, that the utensils they didn't use anything, but that's what they say. The final thing I want to point out is that there is a posek in Israel. His name is Rabbi Yaakov Epstein. He's published about 27 volumes. Oops, let me get rid of this. 27 volumes of... hold on a second... Here's this. Here it is. Yes. 27 volumes of Tshuvot, Chevel Nachlato. And he has, for those who want to explore this further, a very they it's been put online. So volume 22, number 27, he deals at length with Rabbi Fixler's article, his tshuva, and he's not happy with it. He thinks that it's relying on too many heterim, and he's especially concerned that he says that right here, where he says psikat halacha, he says when it comes to paskling halacha, you have to separate between individual questioners and for the tzibur. And his point is that he thinks that for an individual questioner who understands halacha, there could be room to permit in cases like Fixler speaking about. But if you make a blanket ruling like this, that you can eat in vegan restaurants. But remember, Fixler has all these restrictions on it. The average Israeli who's going to go to these places is going to just say, hey, we can go to the vegan restaurant without knowing the restrictions, without paying attention to them. And therefore, Rabbi Epstein says, first of all, it's a mistake. You shouldn't never make a decision like this. He acknowledges that maybe b'shat hadchak, in an emergency, we can find room to permit, but only on an individual case when you know the person will be able to follow the rules. And Rabbi Epstein himself wonders whether he's not sure that it's even permitted because of bishulakum, but he thinks that perhaps we can find a heter for individuals, but in complete opposition to a blanket ruling that you tell people, as Sohar does as well, that you can go there, but you have to follow these restrictions. So what I would say to conclude is that it's an interesting topic, as they always say, ask your local rabbi. And also, I would go further, and I know this. Some of the rabbis might see this as I'm not going to say heresy, but as undermining American Orthodoxy. What I would say is maybe don't ask the local Orthodox rabbi. Maybe when you go to the place you are, ask the local rabbi where you are. Because it's often hard for an American rabbi living in the suburbs of New York to know what it's like when you're wandering in one of these places and what life is like there. On the other hand, if you ask the rabbi, the local rabbi, so for instance, when we're in Italy, I was told by the rabbi of Livorno we could eat all the ice creams, I forgot what the name of it is. It's the same thing as Strauss and Agida or something like that. He says, because he investigated it and there's no tarfus in it. And I was told the same thing in Spain by the rabbi of Barcelona. No American rabbi is going to tell you that when you're in these countries, you could eat something without hashkacha. Problem is they don't have hashkachas there, and everyone eats without hashkacha because the rabbis come out with lists. So if the local rabbi, as it happened to me in Nairobi, if the local rabbi tells me that I've looked into it and I can tell you at that vegan restaurant you can eat there, that's what I mean when I say ask the local rabbis. We've had these problems on our trips. I'll just give you an example. All throughout Europe, including Gibraltar, and if you've been to Gibraltar, you know it's a Haredi community with a Haredi Rav, but all the Hashkachas in Europe, for the coffee that you drink, they use the hotel coffee of the hotel. Now, I've been told by people, I don't drink coffee, so I don't pay attention to this, but no, I've been told that no Hashkacha in America would allow, let's say, if it was at a hotel, they would allow you, if you had a wedding or something, they'd allow you to use the coffee of the, let's say, a breakfast the following morning and it's catered. They never would allow you to use the mugs of the hotel. And they'll give you all these reasons because they put them in the dishwasher with the tray, whatever it is. It never would happen in America. And I tell you that that's what the shkacha is, that they're all, in fact, the guy in Gibraltar, when someone questioned it, he said, you have a problem, take it up with the Rav. But that, it's not just in Gibraltar. I've seen it everywhere. And there's good reasons for it. Rav Yosef has a whole tshuva on this, that it's not an issue. They only, what do they have in it? They only have milk and coffee, and the dishwasher is not a problem, or at least they hold it's not a problem. For all sorts of reasons, if you've learned Yoruday, you'll understand. The point is that it's not that we're right, they're wrong, or Americans. It's that that's their minhag, that's what they do. And if you want to know about the vegan restaurant, the psak of the rabbi, if he's a reliable rabbi, I'm not told, but you assume a community rabbi is a reliable rabbi. If he tells you that this is okay, what we do in New York is very different. New York, we're blessed with all sorts of restaurants and everything. If you're in the middle of nowhere, I'll end with this. I was in Spain when I was planning our trip to Spain. I went for 2 whole days without any hot food. Forget hot food. I lived on fruit and Ben and Jerry's for 2 days. And this was a big leniency for me, Ben and Jerry's, because after the Women's March, when Ben and Jerry's when all the other people backed out, Ben and Jerry's still supported the women's march, the anti-Semitic women's march. Tamika Mallory, that acolyte of Farrakhan, now she's on the Cadillac commercials. But I gave up my, I gave my psak that no Ben and Jerry's. And my wife, we used to get the low-fat Cherry Garcia all the time. My wife, I have to say, bless her soul, this has now been about 5 years. It hasn't been in her house once. We find other things substituted. However, when we're on the trips, I also gave the psak. Put it in quotation marks. I get to myself. I said that I'm like the Nobi Hudits, but Diavad, I have nothing else to eat. There wasn't any Haagen-Dazs. So I held that, I poskened for myself. I'm allowed to eat Ben and Jerry's and that, but it's not. And then on our Greece trip, we had Ben and Jerry's, you know, they all with the hashgacha and everything. But in all seriousness, unless you've lived in places where there literally is no food, so it's very easy in the New York area to say that we never would have hashgacha to an Indian restaurant for all these reasons. When you go out to a place like some of these small towns in America and they find this, they're able to make kosher one of these Indian restaurants. And there's other considerations. If you didn't make it kosher and provide an outlet, then a lot of these Jews, they'd still go to the Indian restaurant, but it wouldn't be under any hashgacha, or they'd go to the non-kosher restaurants. So I would just end by saying it's not so simple. And for all of you who have these stories of people who said about eating in vegan restaurants, I'm not saying to do it. I don't do it. I mean, generally, well, not just generally, I don't do it at all. We don't do it on tours, and haven't had the opportunity since Oxford. Don't assume that these are not reliable people. We see Rabbi Fixer, we see Shabtai Kohen Repo, we see Tzohar, we see Rabbi David Horowitz from YU. So it's not an open and shut case that it's so 100% usser, absolutely in all cases. I'll just end with that. It's not for me to, I think, speculate anymore on this. Leave it for the rabbis to do it. But that was my question to Rabbi Rappaport. What about the Kalim? And his answer was that he doesn't think the Kalim are a concern. So let's leave it at that. Let me do the final questions of the of this class. Again, 53 classes. Thank you all for staying with us. We've aged. We've seen good things. We've seen bad things. We've seen many people pass away, unfortunately, leaders of the Jewish community. We've seen some very good things, and I've really enjoyed spending it with all the time with you. Susanna says, do the women in Gerba pray? No, they don't pray. They would recite, let me take it back. They would recite a prayer. Traditionally in Gerba, Morocco, they would have a special prayer. They would recite, they would go before the mezuzah many times. They would say a prayer asking God to watch over their family, that thing. But they're not saying Shemona Esrei. They're not doing things like that. Today, however, when I was there, I asked one of the young women, and they said that today they say Shemona Esrei, and they educate them now. There's a girls' school, so they do say that. I was told only the unmarried women, not the married women with the children and everything. Jack Yellen says, perhaps Rabbi Feldman knew his congregant and was very confident regarding her reason for not being in shul. For example, her husband may not have come to shul as well. He does describe her also as someone who didn't take Judaism so seriously. My only point was the idea that she's not interested in praying. He says, you have even people who aren't Orthodox who are interested in praying. The way he describes her, that she appears only rarely in shul, observes absolutely nothing Jewish, and sends her children to private non-Jewish schools. So not the most observant person, but that doesn't, who says that that doesn't mean that she believes in the efficacy of prayer? We're talking years ago. He's talking about these stories when he came to Atlanta. He describes that no one is Shomer Shabbos. They're all, he built a community from where they could barely get a minyan on the Friday night to into a massive community. So it's a different era.
Right. My point was, it's not like the women in Gerba.
It's not like the women in Gerba. No, on the contrary, those women are so pious. That's Dafka, the reason they don't go to shul.
Exactly.
Yaakov, God willing, will go to Gerba. You'll join us, hopefully, when we go. Sharon and Marty say, if you wrap your fingers first and you do everything in reverse, then you remove everything. Do you take the whole shalyad off before you take? Yeah, you take. No, you take the, you would take the shal rosh off, and then you take the shalyad off. Doesn't the Rav story write Tefillin and the Baal Bais now cast doubt on anecdotal stories in general? I saw the Rav do it this way versus I spoke directly with the Rav regarding the same matter. Well, look, these anecdotal stories you never believe. You take them with a grain of salt. But what he's saying is that, I don't know if he's saying as an eyewitness or you heard it, someone asked the Rav why. And someone says, why are you doing it this way? And the Rav said, oh, I forgot. And why'd the Rav say, I forgot? The Rav say, I forgot, because the Rav doesn't want to start explaining, the lundus to the Balabas. That's all. David Eisen says, how about the first words of Birkat Kohen? Mose Yevarechacha. Well, I believe it should be Yevarech. It should be Yevarechacha, because it's both a chaf. So according to the assumption that when you have the two of the same letters, like hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Although the Radak says it's ha-lu, but that would be an example of where it would be yevarechecha, not yevarecha. Nissan says, is calling Alexa or Sirle calling the Shema Kotev? I think it is. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe actually has a whole piece on this, in which there's the Gemara in Shabbos speaks about, if you speak to an animal and you force an animal to do work on Shabbos, like say, move, move, that's usher. So that you can analogize that to the Shema Kosev and other things. Donnie says the pen may not write with the voice, but computers can transcribe speech. The voice is more problematic than with your mind. What Rabbi Fixler was speaking about there is now they have it where it's just attached to your mind, where you don't do anything and you just hear it. And just in your mind, you just think it. We have no sources, as far as I know, for that. It seems like it would be a machokas. Barry says, a book on halachic writings by women is entitled Jewish League Writings by Women, and has many tshuvot on tefillin, etc. Yes, I have that book. It's a nice purplish cover. I'm sure Rabbi Kelman has it as well. But that's different because that's a series of articles by individual women. What I showed you from Rabbanit Petrakovsky, if that's her name, that's an entire volume. And it shows that she's an expert, not just, I'm not taking away from the women who contributed to that book, but what they did is they researched and wrote on one area. Here you have the Rabbanit, she's writing on every area. So she's a Bakia, is it Bakia? I don't even know. Bakit, Bakia, David can tell us. She's writing on everything. So that, and that's a classic halachic writer. They can write on all different areas, or at least, I shouldn't say everything. It's not Chosh and Mishpat here, but it's on all sorts of areas, of variety of areas of halacha, going into some of the, I think it was just like Yerodea type of issues here, and mostly Orachayim, but the entire Orachayim. I'm impressed with that. Judith says, is that not being a Moser? Is it okay to kill other Jews? I'm not sure. You have to remind me about killing other Jews, what I said about killing other Jews and being a Moser. I don't remember the case. Jack says, if I'm not mistaken, Michal Shurkin regularly attended a Moshe Feinstein Shurim in the 70s. Indeed, he did. That's one of his Rebbeim. But he, like a few others, decided they also wanted the Torah from Brisk in America. So they started attending the yeshiva. So started attending the Rav Shir at Ritz. And Barry says, Rav Shurkin's father is Rosh Yeshiva Chaim Berlin, and he and Vermechel learned many years of Meiselman. Oh, with the Rav, sorry. Rav Meiselman changed. He had a PhD in math. And when he was with Yeshiva's Brisk with Zonkor Varn, he taught math, and his Hashrafa changed. Yes, his Hashrafa changed a great deal. You even have debates in print with Rabbi Yosef Blau and with other people over how to portray the Rav. Susanna,
I actually learned with Michal Shurkin, now that you're reminding me, a number of times at Teres Yerushalayim, just to the point.
Big, big Lamdan. Only that, he carries on the tradition of the Rav's Torah. He's published Sfarim of the Rav's Torah. It says on the first page, though, Av based in Boston. He doesn't identify him as YU, but he's responsible to a large extent of, there's a couple others as well, of bringing the Rav's Torah into the Haredi world. So he gets all, it's a big zechus for him. Susanna says there was a restaurant somewhere in New York City that gave food to a Buddha that was sitting in the front. Before they gave it to you, they gave it to the Buddha? Okay, but what does that mean? They don't believe the Buddha eats the food. What that is, if they do it with the Jains also, it's a sign of respect or whatever it is, the food, whatever it is. It doesn't mean it's Avodah Zarah. And if it is Avodah Zarah, maybe it is Avodah Zarah, but does, if they believe the Buddha is actually a god, Does that mean that the food can't be eaten or anything? I don't know.
I wasn't there. I don't know the restaurant, but I know a rabbi who when he ate there when he was in rabbinical school at JTS. Yeah. And then on his way out, he saw this Buddha with food in front of it. So he asked, he said, oh, yeah, we're giving to the, you know, it's like an offering to the Buddha. Then he went and asked his professor at JTS who said, you can't eat any there anymore.
Okay, no, that's, you give an offering, but that doesn't mean the food that you're eating they gave is an offering. They do. They give it to the, they do it. That doesn't mean the food though that they gave you. The Hindus also give an offering to their gods, but they don't, and so do the Jains. They don't believe in gods, but they're founders. But that doesn't mean the food that they're going to serve you, they give to them. Catholics also do the Eucharist. I mean, I don't know. That doesn't, I don't know how it affects us. If someone can explain. Mark says, I think kosher organization would be concerned at restaurants serving Shemitah produce. But let me ask this question, Mark. I'm at a restaurant here, and all of a sudden we run out of lettuce and or run out of apples. And I run down to the supermarket and I bring down a thing of apples. The mashgiach is going to say, well, we got to go to the shop, right? And we have to get on the phone with the distributor at who distributes it in the main office and find out where this batch came from.
But you know when you pick up the, if it were clearly marked as Israel, you know.
No, but it's not. Israel. They're never marked. If they're marked as Israel, that's a different issue. We're talking about in the restaurant, though, where Rabbi Leibowitz said you have to find out where it comes from, but it's not marked. That's the whole point. Yes, if it said from Israel, then you'd have there'd be a different issue. But you know, you go in there, you often it doesn't say anything one way or the other. So I don't see that as someone privately says that he was rabbi in Japan. He's privately saying this to me, chief rabbi of Japan, because no other rabbis, I guess, or you were the rabbi, and that. He testifies that all dishes were made exactly according to traditions, no violations, which is a thank you for Rabbi for telling us that. And that is what we've heard from others. And that's what Rabbi Horowitz relied on. I know that we saw Rabbi Leibowitz doesn't rely on it and many others don't rely on it. In a case like this, you really have to speak to the people like the rabbi texting me in now, Rabbi Marvin Tokayer, people who've actually lived there, who know the culture. It's really hard for people like us in America to speculate about this without knowing what's, that's why I said to, when I say, ask the rabbi, ask the rabbi, the local rabbi of the place you're going to be. And he might also say it's no good. I am certain, because I was in Hong Kong. I am certain 100% that the Chabad rabbi there today would say, absolutely, you cannot eat there. And for good reason. Why would you eat there? They have like three restaurants now in kosher restaurants. So why would you? But I'm telling you, my neighbor here in West Orange tells me that when he was there in the 90s, he was there for a couple of months, some big case there. He says that he was told from the Chabad rabbi, maybe a previous one, there's a few Chabads there, that in this vegan restaurant he could eat. So I don't know. Interestingly, someone texted me that Rabbi Horowitz referred to it as vegetarian, not vegan. I think many people mean, when they say vegetarian, they really mean vegan. They get the lingo wrong. Because vegetarian has a real problem. Vegetarian has all sorts of things that could be problematic that vegan, at least I think they do, maybe not. What could be problematic with vegetarian restaurants other than the wine and the cheese? Well, the cheese, obviously. Cheese is the big one. But some of these places don't have cheese, these like Japanese ones, as far as I know, but Indian ones would have. Yes, so cheese is a vegetarian one, and then the kalim, 100%, the kalim are no good. So vegan is the issue. I think that's what Rabbi Horowitz means. He doesn't mean it. And the rabbi from Japan privately texts me, Klei Einam B'nei Yomo. Okay, this is a principle. Rabbi Fixler mentions this. We say, Stam Kalim Einam B'nei Yomo. The idea is that you don't need to be concerned about a kli after the fact because we assumed it wasn't made within the last 24 hours with tarfus. However, the response to this is that it's very questionable whether this applies to a place like a restaurant where because they're using it constantly. If, let's say, someone in their house, you have a kli, haven't used it probably, who knows when you we can say that. And if someone then cooked, let's say, dairy in a meat pot or something, the last time you used it would be of significance. It's a big machokas about restaurants and also in otherwise. Yes, Rosa says that one of my coworkers who was strict vegan would only eat kosher cheese. The problem is she's not a strict vegan because a vegan would never eat cheese, even if it's kosher, because vegans don't eat any milk product. let's see. Although no, that's, I take that back. They do eat the milk. Vegans, Jains. I'm sorry, Jains. You're right, Jains. Well, vegans will not eat any milk product. Jains, who are almost vegan, they will eat milk. So here, Rabbi Nawi identifies. Rabbi Shugnow was the rabbi in Japan, and as I said to you privately, and we'll, as we're almost here, we salute you for your service. And David Eisen says, I received a tshuva from a posek in Israel that one can order falafel anywhere outside of Israel from a vegan falafel stand, assuming the pitot are pot palter and made only out of flour and water. The ground chickpeas are not al shulchan malachim. And after confirming that the oil is vegetable oil, which should be the case if the falafel shop is vegan, and there typically are no leafy vegetables, that create a concern for bugs. So David, just privately, we'll keep it to ourselves. If you can send me an email privately, which posek that was, I'd be curious if you can share it. I've never relied on that, and it's interesting. There is something we have in America now called pliables. Acai bowls. And you have this place called pliables. You have other, it's like it's made of a fruit. It's only fruit. It shouldn't be a problem at all. You should be able to eat it anywhere. And my niece told me that one of the rabbis in Boca said you can eat it anywhere, although there are places that have ashkacha. But I mean, at the end of the day, if you go into a store and the store only sells fruit, of course you can eat fruit from a store. Once you start cooking, then it gets a little more problematic. But thank you for that, David. David says also, apropos of Shabtai Rappaport, he says, Yivarecha with a shva, like I said, and then notes that Yivarecha is exceptions. There's no guy under the word. Well, I have to send this to me all. If it's Moshe Bar Asher, the head of the Academy of Hebrew Language, he's the expert. Okay, with this, actually, you don't need to save it to me, David. I'm going to make a copy of this now, and I'll see about this later. I thank you all again. This was, I learned so much from all the questions and comments. I've never had such a hard crowd. It's tough. It keeps me on my toes. When you have 50 people who know things about all sorts of things, including from the very beginning, we had one of the Canadian Scrabble champions on the show. So we had the question about the word porging, which I wondered whether that was a Scrabble word or not. But it's to be prepared for you guys, take something. Let me tell you that. So I hope I've measured up to a large extent on the, especially with the questions on my toes. It's not so simple without preparing, but I think I, most of the time, if I didn't get it right, I tried to report the next week. So thank you all. With that, I say thank you to Rabbi Kelman for making this wonderful medium available to us.
Thank you. I'm the Shadchan, that's it. But thank you very much, really. A pleasure. We look forward to, I was hoping August 2nd, I don't know, August 2nd, August 9th. But really, I do recommend those who are newish, new, I mean, since last March, when we started with the shiur on Kitniot. And then we did, of course, the series on Shanghai, the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai, the four-part series. And then we went the 53 weeks on this. But before that, like I mentioned in the beginning, we have about, 200 talks on people from Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the son from Rebbe, Rav Shimshon from Falhurs, Israel Hildesheimer, the Chatam Sofer, Rav Moshe, now I forget his name.
Moshe Kunitz,
yeah. I mean, less known, more known, well-known, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, Haredi, modern, the range, the Netziv, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Henkin Sr. So really, if you're looking for stuff to do on the summer, you can download the hundreds of talks on Great Rabbinic Series, and that series will please go out and start up back in August. So we look forward and want to thank you. Really, this was a hiatus just for a few weeks, as we've discussed, till the library's open and he can get his notes and research and stuff. And of course, a few weeks turned into 53. But okay, that's, like I say, a year plus a week of good luck. So thank you all, and we look forward to learning. Of course, we have, as you all know, many shiurim beyond this. And next is tomorrow morning, Rachel Sharansky-Danziger on storytelling and the rise of kings. That's at 11 a.m. And the Sefer Yirmiyahu on Wednesday with the Simi Peters and Moshe Sokolow. Wednesday night, the Haftorah. Thursday, Shuli Mishkin on on touring Israel, always fascinating. And the Parsha Shir this week, Rabbi Yossi Levin of the Jewish Center on 8060 the west side of Manhattan, and then my Shir Perkei Avot Friday morning, and Rabbi Liebtag, of course, Sunday on Sefer Dvarim, and Alex Israel with part three next week on Lord Jonathan Sacks, going his books. That was a fascinating talk for those who were there this morning. And we look forward to learning with you. We have a few other things actually coming up. I mentioned this morning our medical ethics conference on July 11th, full day, meaning morning, like 9:30 to 1, I believe, and then 7 to 9:30 at night. And there are CME credits for those who are medical professionals or would like, but even if you're not, this is a sort of a makeup from what we used to be our live conference in the summer that obviously we can't do. Still, please go out next year, but I invite everybody up from Steinberg, Aaron Glatt, Eddie Reckman, David Pelkowitz. It's really a top-notch lineup. So that's on Sunday, July 11th, and please God, I don't know if that's the right word exactly, but Sunday, July 18th is Tisha B'Av. We'll have, I guess, this will, that's how I got started in all of this. Part of the history, 1989. I came back to Toronto. I was living in New York. I came back to Toronto in 1988, and I twiddled my thumbs on Tisha B'Av. There was absolutely nothing going in Toronto in 1988. The whole day, nothing. I went out of my mind. So in 1989, I organized the program. And that was the sort of, I don't know if you want to see the rudiments of Torah in Motion. That program ran live every year in Toronto, an all-day program, keynote explanation in the morning, speakers in the afternoon. We get the whole afternoon of speakers. Last year, we went online, and this year also. We have the advantage we can have speakers from Israel. They have the advantage they can speak after the fast is over, if they'd like. Some want to speak before the fast, after the fast. So it's not fully, I don't have everything worked in, but in the next few days, they have a number of speakers who will, both from Israel and here, who will be speaking. That's the 18th. So, and then a couple other new series will be starting. I'll keep you posted on that. So that's lots of announcements. Taking me a long time to say everything going on. So we look forward. So we look forward to learning with you. Like I always say, invite a friend. That's the best way. We don't have a big advertising budget and this and that. The best way is invite your friends. If you enjoy it, to come, listen to some of the talks, and we look forward to learning with you. And
And I would say, if you enjoy, make a donation.
Yes, that's true. I'll send a letter. Yes, I'm not good at asking for money. I don't think I ask enough, but maybe people think I ask too much on your perspective. But yeah, at the end of the series, 53 weeks.
And Rabbi Kelman's now giving it away for free. He's putting it on YouTube. So
whatever, we're happy to do it for free. We're happy to do that. But Imein Kemach Ein Torah. And I know there's some people online who have made donations, and I want to thank you. But for those who haven't, really, it is important. And it can only be done through everything we do. We're 100% dependent on donations. We have no full-time staff in Torah Motion. It's all it's a shoestring operation. You'd be shocked if you knew what went on behind the scenes. But Baruch Hashem, we do a lot, and lots of people around the world, but we do it on a shoestring budget, and I'd like to tie the shoes a little tighter, so if you can help me. So that would be great. Thank you, Mark, once you put it in.